Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun, highs 44 to 51. West winds 5 to 15. Sunny on Thursday, highs in the upper 40s to mid 50s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Running interference. Just days into the Canadian federal election campaign, new concerns about foreign interference and allegations India may have meddled in the Conservative Party's leadership race in 2022.
And the hearths of the matter. Thousands of homes were destroyed by fire in Altadena, but in some cases their fireplaces and chimneys are still standing. The historic decorative tiles on those fireplaces may be the only thing that survived relatively unscathed. We'll hear from one of the people who's working to save them and get them back to the homeowners.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. We also thank Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz to manage voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. We're going to listen now to our album of the week. It is Lonesome Drifter by Charlie Crockett. He is a musician from Texas, and this is his 15th album in 9 years. This one produced by Shooter Jennings. Crockett channels 1970s Nashville country sound with one foot set in 2025. The song we're going to hear this evening is his cover of George Strait's Amarillo by Morning.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I've got is just what I've got on. When that sun is high in that Texas sky, I'll be bucking at the county fair. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo, I'll be there. They took my saddle in Houston, broke my leg in Santa Fe, lost my wife and a girlfriend somewhere along the way. I'll be looking for aid when they pull that gate, and I hope that judge ain't blind. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo's on my mind. Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I've got is just what I've got. Amarillo's where I'll be.
from our album of the week. That is Charlie Crockett and his cover of George Strait's Amarillo by Morning. The album's called Lonesome Drifter. You can read more about it at kaxc.org. Also, let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is more ahead from As It Happens on KAXC. Also at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, DJ Dang, your host for Headwaters. University of Minnesota Extension presents Fridays with a Forester. It's an online series each Friday at 9 a.m., now through the end of April. These informal sessions will feature a different topic each week. To learn more and to register, visit z.umn.edu/Fridays2025. Watermark Art Center in Bemidji has the annual High School Invitational Exhibit opening Friday, April 4th, with a reception from 5 to 6:30. The show will run through April 25th. You can let us know what's going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Thanks for tuning in this evening. We continue now with As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Heavy metal. Intelligence sources allege India had a hand in organizing support for Pierre Poilievre's conservative leadership bid in 2022, which raises questions, including what that might mean during a federal election.
Cinema all too verite. One of the directors of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land is beaten and detained in the West Bank. An activist there tells us about getting video of the attack.
Granular details. We'll talk politics with an Alberta farmer who tells us the tariff threats from China and the U.S. are so destabilizing, he's not even sure what crops he'll be able to plant this spring.
Sidelined. The Afghan women's soccer team has not been allowed to play in international competitions since the Taliban took over Afghanistan. The team's founder says it is past time for FIFA to allow the players back on the pitch.
Tile by fire. In fire-ravaged Altadena, the race is on to save ornate fireplace tiles that hold a century of history before the bulldozers come and knock them down.
And flying into a rage. 2 hours into a 13-hour flight, a pilot makes a shameful announcement. He's forgotten his passport.
Oh, no.
So the plane with 257 passengers on board will have to turn around. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that would have opted for the silent retreatment. Foreign interference is always a concern during elections, and today on the campaign trail, the issue was front and center. Canadian intelligence services have learned that agents of India allegedly raised money and organized support for Pierre Poilievre during the race to become the leader of the Conservative Party, a race Mr. Poilievre ultimately won. The story was first reported by the Globe and Mail and confirmed by Radio Canada, and intelligence sources say there's no evidence that Mr. Poilievre and his team were aware of the alleged efforts. The news has reignited the debate over the Conservative leader's refusal to get his security clearance, and it follows a public inquiry into foreign interference which concluded that China and India had meddled in Canadian elections. Stephanie Carvin is a professor at Carleton University and a former CSIS intelligence analyst. We reached her in Ottawa.
Stephanie, does the timing of this news, this information coming out, signal anything to you?
Well, it is a little strange, admittedly. And I mean, to be clear, I don't know when the reporters, Steve Chase and Robert Fife, who have broken so many of the stories on foreign interference that have kind of led to inquiries and things like this, it's not clear to me when this information was provided to them. Yes, it is a little strange. Certainly, it's inconvenient for Mr. Poilievre, and it certainly raised questions that, you know, I think perhaps he had hoped to put to a bed last year.
Pierre Poilievre did respond to this reporting today. Here's part of what he said.
Let's be honest. I won the leadership fair and square. Even my political competitors, like Mr. Patrick Brown, have publicly testified under oath that that was the case.
Pierre Poilievre spokesperson Sam Lilly has said the campaign in that leadership race followed all the rules. We know Pierre Poilievre won it with 68% of the vote. So even if there was meddling, it's not likely that it changed the outcome. Should Canadians be concerned?
So Mr. Poilievre is correct. I mean, there does not appear to have been, at least according to media reports on the intelligence, any sign that his team knew that this was in fact happening. And I think that it's important, you know, Canadians should continue to have confidence in our system. Despite all of the attention, there doesn't yet seem to have been a successful foreign interference campaign in this country. Now, that being said, I think the concern is that it's not like states try once and then walk away saying, "Ah, shucks, that didn't work." What effectively they're doing is they're learning, right? They're always calibrating their efforts. So if one way didn't work, they'll adjust. A lot of the controversy about this has been that Pierre Poilievre does not want to get the security clearance that would enable him to protect his own party.
I wanted to ask you about that because he did speak about that issue of security clearance again, as he does in response to these issues and as he has in the past on this issue. So let's play that for our listeners as well.
On the security clearance, I've already had a security clearance because I was a cabinet minister, so I've already been cleared. What I will not do is commit to the oath of secrecy that the Liberals want to impose on me. They don't want me to be able to speak about these matters. So they bring me into a dark room and they'll say, "We're going to give you a little bit of breadcrumbs of intel, and then we'll tell you you can't talk about any of this stuff anymore."
So there's a few points there, but let's talk about this oath of secrecy framing. Is there any truth to the scenario he's describing?
So the truth to the scenario is that, yes, if he had been provided very specific information about the campaign that was in the news today, he could not talk about certain operational aspects of that, right? But where I think this falls down is that we've now had two reports from the Foreign Interference Commission, the second one which talks about this episode in great detail, as well as the various reports of the National Security Review bodies that have come out. I think there's been at least like three or four other reports that have been there. So the idea that there's a muzzle there, or you couldn't talk about the, quite frankly, numerous failures of the Liberal Party when it was in power to counter foreign interference, just strikes me as false. I mean, we know for a fact, and it's been documented, that, you know, intelligence didn't go the way it should, that, intelligence would sit on desks. In the case of Bill Blair, there was a number of failures there that Pierre Poilievre could, in fact, continue to speak to. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a political choice. It's his choice to get it or not. And, you know, if he feels that this is the best way forward, I mean, that's for the voters to judge.
The other point he mentioned was that he was already cleared as a cabinet minister. We heard another Conservative guest just last week make that reference as well. What do you make of the fact that they're raising that?
Yeah, I mean, so a security clearance it lasts for about 5 years. It is absolutely true that he would have had a security clearance as a cabinet minister. And in fact, he probably would have had greater access to information as a cabinet minister than he would as leader of the opposition. But I'm trying not to be partisan here because, you know, this isn't, I just find it odd that he feels that given the failures that were identified in publicly, that he feels that he couldn't talk about that. I think it's a bit late in the day. I mean, we're in a 35-day campaign right now. So, you know, if he's not elected and he stays on as leader of the opposition, then maybe he'll get one. But it's not clear to me that there's really either the time or place now before the election occurs at the end of April.
In response to questions about this, the Conservative leader pointed the finger and raised concerns about Liberal leader Mark Carney. We know that Mark Carney resigned as chair of the board at Brookfield when he announced that he was running to lead the Liberal Party. But Mr. Poilievre is suggesting Carney's recent position with Brookfield Asset Management, which has a loan with the Bank of China, should raise questions of national security. Is there any merit to the questions and concerns he's raising there?
I mean, there has been an issue of foreign interference with banks in Canada, right? There has been a lot of reporting about Wealth One Bank and allegations that they were engaged in foreign interference. So this is not an entirely out of the blue argument for Mr. Poilievre to make. I would note that it was done through a corporation. This does seem to be public knowledge. So, it's not clandestine in that particular way, but this is where transparency is important. And I think this is an important thing, I think, to keep in mind for this election. So it's like, you know, even Danielle Smith, like, you know, she talked about, you know, getting, you know, trying to convince like Trump not to go so hard on the on Canada, so, you know, because she felt it was hurting the Polyev campaign, or Mr. Carney and his banking loan. But like the one thing that kind of ties all of these stories together is the perception of foreign interference, like whether or not it's actually occurred. It's like, I think we have to hold politicians to a standard that they're not seen or not putting themselves in a position where there's questions about this, because honestly, we've been kind of freaked out about this issue in this country, rightfully so in some ways, for 2 years. And, you know, politicians need to use transparency. They need to use all the tools in their toolkit to show that, yes, they are protecting their political parties. And yeah, so I think this is how we're in this situation right now. Politicians from all parties could, quite frankly, do a better job.
Stephanie, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie Carvin is a professor at Carleton University and a former CSIS intelligence analyst. We reached her in Ottawa. During an election campaign, everything is even more political than usual, which is why Alberta Premier Danielle Smith's recent remarks are getting so much attention. She's facing criticism for saying that she advised American officials to pause the tariff dispute with Canada because it was benefiting the Liberal Party. That has prompted a lot of angry back and forth. But in the meantime, a lot of Albertans have other things on their minds. Throughout this campaign, we'll be asking voters across the country what political issues are affecting their lives, where they're feeling the squeeze. And tonight we'll ask Stephen Vandervolk. He's a grain farmer in Fort McLeod, Alberta. We reached him today in Calgary.
When we last spoke, Stephen, on this show, there was a grain elevator strike that was interfering with shipping. It was a really stressful time for you. Now, tariffs from China on one of your crops, canola. So what is it like to be a farmer in Alberta right now?
Definitely hasn't gotten better, for sure. Prices have even dropped further since then, and that has to do with many things, but, you know, probably mainly to do with both the threats of the U.S. tariffs was number one. And then it wasn't a coincidence that China came in when they did on these tariffs. They're trying to drive the market down, and they're successful at it, for sure. And so we're trying to seed here in the next couple of weeks, and I can tell you one thing, there's not a lot of optimism right now out west here, for sure.
And as you head into that part of your season, seed season, do you know what you're going to be planting?
Normally you would know by now. This tariff thing came on quite late, so you already have all your canola seed bought. Do you send it back, or do you plant it, hoping things are going to change? You know, things change in a hurry too, right? So, you know, I can tell you from my farm, I actually don't know quite yet. I probably have 80% of my farm kind of dialed in, but we will be making sort of last-minute decisions on the last 20% on, you know, do we put more malt barley in or feed barley or in less canola or, you know, more durum or things like that. So, yeah, you kind of need to know in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. And of the crops, the alternatives you mentioned, how are you leaning right now? I mean, how do you choose before that deadline?
Well, it's tough because there is no alternatives, because we've had a lot of missteps by our previous, well, our current government, I guess, on many different countries. We're not really friendly with India. They've got tariffs on pulses. You know, now we're having troubles with the United States. We've always had troubles with China over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. And so you can't really pick, because something else has a problem too. Yeah, it's... I don't know. You're going to have to hold your nose and pick a crop and just hope things change. Yeah. And that's a really crappy way of doing business.
What would ease the pressure you and your fellow farmers, Stephen, are feeling at this point?
I think a lot of people will be surprised. You'd think farmers, what's your biggest risk and what's your biggest issue in farming? And everybody would say the weather. And that's partially true. But I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, it's been government policy and just making decisions like putting a tariff on EVs. And they knew perfectly well that that tariff would for sure result in agricultural tariffs put on Western Canada by China. And so we just need to get out there. Let's work with other countries. Let's strengthen our trading relationships. and work on being a better supplier and not having strikes. It seems like every month there's a different strike and we're just not reliable. Just fixing little things like that, stuff that is actually in our control. Weather isn't in our control, but these things are. And if we can go out there and do that, that would be a huge help.
I know you also have another business. You build rental housing units outside of the big cities, but in Alberta. Yep. There is a housing crisis across the country. You're well aware. What is it like as you try to do that work?
It's very difficult to do that for a few reasons. It's very hard to find land that's zoned for multifamily, and then getting through all the red tape to do the building. It just takes months, if not years, to get this stuff done. And so, you know, we can build a nineplex in 4 months, and that's with one crew. So if you put multiple crews out, you can build a lot of housing really fast if you just have the land and that's zoned properly with all the permits and all that other fun stuff. The cost, the first day that they announced tariffs, we got a across-the-board 10% increase on all your plumbing products, to windows, to doors. And so the costs are just skyrocketing. And so we're trying to keep rents affordable, right? And you can't get new builds unless there's, you know, a margin or a profit margin in there for builders. That's just a reality.
And I'll ask you about some of what the major party leaders are doing and saying. And in terms of connection to the West, to Alberta, Liberal leader Mark Carney, we know is from Edmonton, has been there several times in the last little stretch, not running there, but has made his presence known there. Does it make any difference to you that he is from Edmonton and has made it a point to come there so far?
So anything's better than what we had. Carney, I find that, yes, him being from Alberta, obviously, that definitely is better. But basically, the Liberal government running today is basically the same Liberal government that was running before Mark Carney became leader. I'd say very little has changed. Find it very disingenuous for Mark Carney to say we're scrapping the carbon tax when he has been
the consumer
very,
carbon tax,
huge proponent of it, huge proponent of it, even saying that we're not charging enough. And how has he done a 180?
Even if they didn't get your vote, you know, is there anything the Liberals could say to have you put more faith in them again, even if they didn't get your vote?
Yeah, I would say quit throwing agriculture under the bus. I understand that Liberals do not represent basically any rural ridings in this country, and for sure zero out west. You know, and a perfect example is this EV tariff that they put on. They knew that was going to happen, and they decided to make that choice because it was a good deal for them. They were saving jobs and saving industry out east at the expense of out west. And so we need to stop doing that. That would be number one thing I would suggest. And another thing is, you know, just quit coming after our oil and gas industry. Yeah. Everybody uses oil and gas. I mean, obviously, we would all die in this country if we didn't have oil and gas, just because we need to heat our homes. And so why pick on just Alberta and our industry and say everything's onus is on us, when all the industry out east is using that same product, but none of the onus is on them?
And as you know, and as our listeners know, Alberta is predominantly conservative in terms of how people there vote. As you listen to Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, do you have any criticisms or questions for Mr. Poilievre?
Yeah, so, you know, I do have some concerns about, we do have a huge deficit. We need to get our debt under control. Cutting taxes is a great way to do that, but at the same time, we need to make sure that there's still enough revenue. Basically, just always costing of anybody's platform. Can you back up your claims?
Stephen, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Anytime, appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and I really appreciate having an agricultural perspective on things.
We're glad to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen van der Valk is a grain farmer in Fort McLeod, Alberta. He is in Calgary. That was the first in a series of conversations with voters across the country during this federal election campaign, in which we will find out where people are feeling the squeeze. And there are a lot more to come before April 28th. The wildfires that hit Los Angeles earlier this year were catastrophically destructive, burning more than 9,000 houses to the ground. But in the rubble of some homes, one structure is still standing, the fireplace. In many cases, it's all that's left. Maura Hudson is the co-founder of Save the Tiles, a volunteer group that's dedicated to preserving the historic fireplaces. We reached her in Altadena, California.
Maura, I know you've spent hours and hours walking up and down the streets of Altadena. You are in the burn zone as we speak. If I was with you, you know, if we were with you, what would we see?
Well, right now I'm at the corner of Mariposa and Glen Rose. I am looking at the San Gabriel Mountains as we speak. Right around me are a bunch of tall burned trees, shells of what used to be craftsmen homes, burned out cars. Really, like, the things that stick up only that's left are fireplaces and tile.
And what do the fireplaces look like, Maura?
The main exception for a number of these homes are the inclusion of these decorative tiles that were made, gosh, over 100 years ago by various craftsmen as part of what we call the arts and crafts movement. Mm-hmm. Ernest Batchelder is probably one of the most known makers of these decorative tile. And there's others like Claycraft, Calco, there's beautiful Spanish tile. And in a number of these homes, that's between the fireplace and the tiles that were on them, that's all that's left.
What do those tiles represent to you and others who want to save them?
They represent history of Altadena, of Pasadena, of my growing up in this area. I grew up in a town called Arcadia, right on the border of Altadena and Sierra Madre. I think growing up, I didn't quite fully appreciate the history of what these homes represented architecturally, and also the families lived in them until they were gone. And being friends with so many people here, making so many new friends, it's become more and more urgent for me to do my part as a resident of this area to save them.
And what is your organization doing to save them? What are the logistics involved?
Save the Tiles is working against time. It's a race against time to find homeowners of these tiles and of these properties. Our co-founder, Eric Garland, and his daughter first realized the seriousness of trying to save these tiles when they walked down the street of their burned residential area. And his daughter said, well, what about the tiles? So a week later, 50 of us walked these streets starting to catalog where these tiles were located. And ever since then, we've been trying to find these homeowners, about 250 of them, to ask if we can go and help them remove them and restore them, repair them, and return them.
And what do they say in response? What kinds of stories are they sharing with you? Because they're dealing with so much.
They are dealing with so much, and it's been a very sensitive time just to try to find them. But when I've talked to them, every single time they've been crying. They've been so super happy that we're helping them, because literally this is the only thing of value left, not only from an architectural significance, but also their personal family history of owning the home. Former owners have reached out to us about tile in the homes that we're trying to rescue. So it's been very personal and humbling to be able to help them preserve this last remaining bit of their personal history with the home, as well as the history of the community.
Yeah, that's what struck me as we've been speaking, Maura, that architectural history, as you were saying, but the family histories that are intertwined, and also the as we've been hearing since the fires broke out, the fight to keep Altadena and its history, to save it. It's been extremely important for Black communities and small business owners, we've heard. So this is one small piece of that. But is that what keeps you going?
Oh, absolutely. I met a woman, her name's Felicia Ford. I have goosebumps talking about her. She reached out to us off of a postcard. She hadn't seen us in the news. She hadn't seen us on social media. There's just been so much to absorb. And when she finally found us, she said, I've got one for you. First of all, I bought this house last July, and it used to be Rodney King's family's residence.
Oh my.
And growing up in this area, knowing the history of that story and the riots, I couldn't believe who I was talking to. And, you know, she's a mom of adult children. She's an advocate for kids with special needs. She has personal connection to that. And she had to leave this home that she was enamored with because in part of this tile. And, you know, as soon as I heard that story, I wanted to be part of the rescue from beginning to end. And so I met with her. I met with her daughter. We walked her property. I learned more about her. And then miraculously, we were able to get a crew together. We have certified masons that are specializing in this thing, come and rescue this pictorial scene of early California with the mountain range that I'm looking at right now, and rescue that and the tile that surrounds it for her. And that was just incredibly humbling and gratifying to be able to help her. And now we text each other and we're friends. And there's lots of examples of that with all the different homeowners in this diverse community that's our home.
It's really lovely to hear the friendship that has come about and the work you're doing to try to help each other, Maura. I appreciate your time. I'm really glad we could speak.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your support. Altadena, it means a lot to so many people, and we're glad to share this story.
Maura Hudson is the co-founder of Save the Tiles. That's a volunteer organization that's working to preserve the fireplaces of homes destroyed by the wildfires. We reached her in Altadena, California. Takeoff was flawless. There's been no turbulence. Your new hat looks great. It's one of those days when you are proud to be a pilot. But then, 2 hours into the flight, while you're playing What Movie Star Does That Cloud Look Like with your co-pilot, it suddenly hits you. It's like a goose was sucked into the jet engine of your heart. You realize you've made a huge mistake, and you have to tell your co-pilot. Ellen, you say, this is your captain speaking. To which Ellen replies, I know, Captain, I'm sitting right here. You continue, Ellen, we're cruising at an altitude of 35,000 feet, and you just compared that cloud to the late Donald Sutherland. We should be arriving in Shanghai at about 6:27 p.m. local time, except we won't, because we have to turn around. Because I left my passport at home. It feels awful to forget your passport, but it probably feels so much awfuler if you are a pilot and you're flying a plane with 257 passengers and you realize you've forgotten your passport 2 hours into a 13-hour flight, so you have to fly back to the airport and everyone on board will have to start the 13-hour flight all over again. And that is what happened on Saturday on a flight from Los Angeles to Shanghai. One of the passengers told CNN she heard the pilot's, quote, very frustrated voice come over the intercom announcing that he had done that very frustrating thing. So everyone lost about 6 hours. The pilot lost face and his bosses probably lost their tempers. It's quite possible that now his future up in the air is really up in the air. Here's Moon River with No Turning Back.
One, two, one, two, three.
This is Moon River with No Turning Back.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, one of the directors of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land was attacked, injured, and detained in the occupied West Bank yesterday. We'll get the latest on his story.
And the founder of Afghanistan's women's soccer team says the team is not allowed to play in international competitions because the Taliban won't sign off on it. She says it is past time for FIFA to change the rules so they can compete, not just for the sake of the players, but for women still in Afghanistan.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howley.
Listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. At 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And more great music continues at 10 o'clock with Headwaters. Your host today is DJ Dang. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And support comes from the New Musical Theater Exchange for the world premiere of a new musical, Water from Snow, April 5th through the 13th at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, featuring original music and area performers telling a story set in rural Minnesota. Tickets available at Four Pines Bookstore or Eventbrite.com. More information on Facebook. Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the 20s, and a mix of clouds and sun tomorrow, highs 44 to 51.
And the Oscar goes to No Other Land.
It's been less than a month since Hamdan Bilal won an Academy Award for directing the documentary No Other Land, alongside fellow Palestinian filmmaker Basil Adra and their Israeli co-creators Yuval Abraham and Rochelle Zor. Less than a month since he walked the red carpet in Los Angeles. And last night, Mr. Bilal found himself in exactly the kind of situation that film about life in the occupied West Bank depicts.
No! No!
Can we go back to the car? Guys, back to the car! Back to the car! Back to the car!
Get in the car! Get in the car!
The sound of activists in the occupied West Bank retreating from an attack by Israeli settlers on residents of Susia, Hamdan Bilal among them. According to witnesses, Mr. Bilal was beaten outside his home before being detained by Israeli military police, who say they arrested, quote, three Palestinians suspected of throwing stones at the force and an Israeli citizen, unquote. Today, after more than 20 hours in detention, the filmmaker and two others were released and treated for their injuries. Anna Lipman is a Canadian activist with the Center for Jewish Nonviolence who filmed the footage we just heard after arriving in Susia yesterday. That's where we reached her.
Anna, how is Hamdan Bilal doing right now?
Hamdan is certainly doing better than he was last night. He was released this afternoon. His friends took him to the hospital. He was in moderate condition, but was released after a few hours and thankfully is home with his wife and children and family.
I know you mentioned he's with his family. He has two young children as well. You saw them last night. What did they tell you about how they're doing?
They were a wreck, of course. You know, especially his children and you know, the children, every time their parents get taken away, it's heartbreaking, right? Because they're so upset. They don't really understand what's happening. They just know the most important, most powerful person in their life is suddenly being taken away. They don't know why. They don't know for how long. He was heard shouting about fearing for his life as he was being hit. Mm-hmm. And his family showed us his blood stains all over his house after. So his children, young kids, the oldest is 7, were very upset last night, you know, trying to be very brave. But, you know, I can tell you absolutely, I think they did not feel whole again until their dad was home with them.
When did you first get word last night that something was happening?
So we got word at about 6 o'clock or so. That's when some of the folks in the village of Susia called us activists and begged us to come and said that something seems to be happening. A large group is coming.
Our listeners just heard before our conversation began a little bit of what was happening when you first arrived. But can you walk us through? So you pull up after getting that call. What happened
right
when you got there?
We pull up. We see kind of the army vehicles, soldiers, lots of sort of shadowy figures. Myself and 2 other activists get out of the car. We take a few steps, and then we're almost immediately ambushed by these young mass settlers carrying sticks and stones. They're yelling at us. They punched one of the people I was with in the face, in the neck. They hit another person I was with a stick. And then they started throwing rocks at us. So we ran back to the car. They surrounded the car. They broke all the windows of the car with the rocks. I truly thought this was the moment where I was going to die. And then in the distance, I hear Basil and some other Palestinian activists running up, yelling at the army to have them stop the settlers from attacking us. And it's actually the commotion of the army and the Palestinians arguing that gets the settlers to leave us.
And Basil, so, we should mention, is Basil Adra, who's a co-creator on the film, as we know. And can you, as all of this is unfolding, do you see Hamdan? Do you know what's happening to him and where he is?
So as we're being attacked, we have no idea where anyone else is. And after the attack is over, as we're standing with the army, they don't let us at first move up to the house. And so a few of the activists that I was standing with, as well as Basil, actually saw the army leading Hamdan away, blindfolded, handcuffed, into an army vehicle. And it was only after that we were able to sort of go up to the house. And then eventually all the army, all the police left, and it was just the families who were just in shock and terrified for their loved ones.
There have been many incidents of violence by settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This particular incident, why do you think it happened? Do you think it has something to do because of his work on No Other Land?
You know, there has been a consistent pattern of these types of attacks in the village of Susia for at least the last month. Certainly the attacks, the frequency and the severity have gotten worse since the movie, since people around the world have begun to understand what is happening in Masafer Yatta. It certainly seems that the settlers here are hoping to finish the job before too much international attention is paid.
Basil Adra told the Associated Press that he feels that this felt to him like punishment for making the film. What did he say to you?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to Basil when we were there standing around with the army, and I asked him, oh, where did you have more fun, at the Oscars party or here? And he just looked at me and gave this dry laugh, right? Because this is the lived everyday reality of people. And, you know, it filled everyone in Misafriata with so much pride to see Basil and Hamdan on that stage. But it broke our hearts to know that the next day they would be back here, subject to the same attacks, subject to the same brutality, and frankly, subject to the whims of settlers who want nothing but revenge, because these Palestinians dare to tell their story with the world, dare to stand up and say, I want to live in my ancestral home.
And I appreciate your time. Please take care.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Lipman is a Canadian activist with the Center for Jewish Nonviolence. We reached her in the village of Susia in the occupied West Bank. They call themselves the Nelson Nerds. Casper Breisness and Eric Bibby are two young engineers who live near Nelson, British Columbia. They're gearing up to compete at an event in Texas next month called the First LEGO League Challenge World Festival, in which students build LEGO robots to complete tasks. Casper and Eric qualified after winning a BC and Yukon championship. This morning they spoke to the CBC. Here's Casper talking about his feelings about heading to Texas.
We're quite excited. We're going to do a couple other things. We're going to go to like the Johnson Space Center and some other fun stuff as well. But it is going to be exciting and tiring, honestly, probably.
I'm sure it will be. And Eric, do you each have different skills that you bring? Like, do you work together on everything?
Generally, I do most of the building, and Casper does most of the coding.
Okay, and Casper, tell us about the LEGO League Challenge World Championships. How does the competition work?
It's a four-day competition. The third day is your actual competitions. So you have three runs. Your best one is the one that scores. And then the last day is the sort of awards and sort of bringing down the energy levels again.
Yeah. Eric, I wonder if you could tell us about your robot, because the theme is ocean this year, right? And I wonder if you could tell us about your robot and what it does, Eric.
So our robot is quite simple. It has two wheels on two motors, and it goes forwards by just turning both forwards, or turns by like making one go slightly slower or something. And it also has two attachment points on the front, which you can just put anything on, and gears interlink to make an arm move or make something push something sideways.
And Eric, how did you two get together? How did you meet? Did you meet at school? How did you realize that you had LEGO in common?
So our dads are both in the local fire department, so
No kidding.
We met through there.
Really?
And we had a dinner together, and we were chatting, and I found out that Casper had a robot, and I did too, so we spent the whole night just building a robot to protect his room from our sisters. That was about 2 years ago.
13-year-old Eric Bibby and 12-year-old Casper Breisness speaking to Chris Walker, host of Daybreak South. The Afghan women's soccer team is sitting on the sidelines yet again. Later this week, the draw for the AFC Women's Asian Cup qualification will take place. That tournament will put teams on track to qualify for the 2027 FIFA Women's World Cup and the 2028 Olympics. When the Taliban took over the country in 2021, the Afghanistan women's national team was forced to flee. And ever since, it hasn't been allowed to play in international competitions. The governing body, FIFA, requires the team to be recognized by the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan Football Federation, and the Taliban refuses to do that. So Amnesty International, the NGO Sport and Rights Alliance, and players are calling on FIFA to change the rules. Khalida Popal is the founder of the Afghanistan Women's National Team. We reached her in Bilbao, Spain.
Khalida, what message do you think it would send for the Afghan women's team to be able to play on the international stage?
I will send a strong message of hope, first of all, for all the Afghan women in Afghanistan, that you're not forgotten, you're seen and you're heard, and we are your voices outside Afghanistan. And the women of Afghanistan is not giving up. They are strong and they are resilient, and we belong to everywhere, and we will not let group of Taliban or anyone to tell us and decide for us where we belong to. We belong to everywhere in the society and in the world.
You're pushing FIFA to change this, to change these rules. What kind of response have you received so far?
It has been more than 3 years that I've been sending emails with the support of different organizations to get response from FIFA, to get FIFA on board, to collaborate with us instead of fighting. We have been requesting, let's collaborate and work together to find the best solution, best safe solution for the players. We are grateful that it has been positive moves, positive conversations mm-hmm. with FIFA. After almost 3 years, FIFA officially committed to supporting the women of Afghanistan, the women football, through different three pillars, and that is supporting women in Afghanistan, supporting the whole advocacy, but also supporting the women in exile, which includes also reactivating the team in exile, collaborating and bringing the players from around the world that they are spread around the world through football trainings, through trials, through friendly games, to get back to FIFA ranking with the hope that they will continue playing and representing Afghanistan.
Does this positive movement that you're talking about, Khalida, mean that they will be able to play in this qualifier and potentially the Women's World Cup and the Olympics in 2028?
Unfortunately not at the Asian football qualification. One of the major concern of FIFA is the safety and security of the players, and that is not having control on choosing the host country. Our games will be played in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, so these countries are seen as not safe for our players to play. And for a player to miss 9 years, they have already lost 5 years, 4 years, and then another 4 years. It'll be 8, 9 years. It is a lot for the players, and we will not have any player by that time. What we want is to find a wild card to be used in during the Olympics and during the other tournaments. If we lost this opportunity this time playing at AFC, we want that wild card to be given to the women of Afghanistan to play on those tournaments.
You were on our show back in 2021. You were helping dozens of players from the national team, but also young women, get out of Afghanistan because they were targeted for playing sports. Their lives were in danger there. You told them to burn their uniforms, to delete their social media accounts. As you stay in touch with them and do, you know, push for changes at FIFA, how are they doing now?
They are working hard. They are really positively, actively engaging in the new community, trying to build a new identity. But they have not forgotten the advocacy to be the voice for the women of Afghanistan. We have youth teams around Europe and the UK. They are active. They are playing football. They are really fighting against the challenges as refugees. But they have not forgotten, and they have not given up on being the voices for the women of Afghanistan. So they are playing football, they are representing the women of Afghanistan, and they are even more visible, more active than even being in Afghanistan. For us, football is our tool. It's our power. We tell the stories. We tell about not football. We talk about the ban on education. We are talking about the new rules by Taliban that it's vanishing and erasing women from the society. So that's how we are doing. And then the rest of the other women from other industries in diaspora and exile, they are using also their voices and platform.
Do you let yourself imagine at this point, that moment, when the women are able to take the pitch in a major tournament, in a FIFA World Cup?
I don't want to lose hope. I don't want to be pessimistic about it. I still want to have the hope, and I still want to fight for the last minute to get our players access to football, to access to the world stages. We are hoping that this will happen. It's possible. We want these governing bodies to forget about their egos and for a minute just listen to the players, because these governing bodies of sport is existing because of the players. We want to remind them they are because of us. These rules and laws are made to protect the human right and right of players. This can be changed because our rights are taken away and the women of Afghanistan cannot play football, cannot represent the country. And that needs to be changed.
Khalida, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Khalida Popal is the founder of the Afghanistan Women's National Soccer Team. She's in Bilbao, Spain. Today, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee met for its annual hearing on global threats. But that group chat ended up focusing on another group chat. Yesterday, Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, published an article detailing how, out of nowhere, he was added to a group chat with top U.S. security officials, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, which was an extremely serious mistake. The participants were discussing very sensitive military planning, including plans for upcoming strikes in Yemen. Today, Democrats grilled National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe about that breach. Here's some of their exchange with Senator Mark Warner.
Director Gabbard, did you participate in the group chat with Secretary of Defense and other Trump senior officials discussing the Yemen war plans?
Senator, I don't want to get into the specifics.
Ma'am, were you on? You're not going to be willing to address. So you're not. Are you denying? Ma'am, will you answer my question, ma'am? You were not TG on this group chat?
I'm not going to get into the specifics.
So you refuse to acknowledge whether you were on this group chat?
Senator, I'm not going to get into the specifics.
Why aren't you going to get into the specifics? Is it because it's all classified?
Because this is currently under review by the National Security
Council. Because it's all classified? If it's not classified, share the text now.
As the White House previously
stated. Is it classified or non-classified information on this text?
I can confirm.
Director Ratcliffe, were you on the group chat?
Senator, I was on a signal messaging group.
So you were the John Ratcliffe on that chat?
I was.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that we're clear, one of the first things that happened when I was confirmed as CIA director was signal was loaded onto my computer at the CIA, as it is for most CIA officers. One of the things that I was briefed on very early, Senator, was by the CIA records management folks about the use of signal as a permissible work use. It is. That is a practice that preceded the current administration to the Biden administration.
Director Ratcliffe, I've got a series of questions. If you're making the statement that signal is a secure channel.
No, can I answer that? It is
end-to-end
encryption. So
it
is permissible to use to communicate and coordinate for work purposes, provided that any decisions that are made are also recorded through formal channels.
Right.
So those were procedures that were implemented. My staff implemented those processes, followed those processes, complied with those processes, and finally, just please. So my communications, to be clear, in a signal message group were entirely permissible and lawful and did not include classified information.
Well, we will make that determination, because if it's not classified, share the text with the committee. You know, let me go on. Director Gabbard, you are the security executive and set access guidelines for classified information. Did you contact the defense secretary or others after this specific military planning was put out and say, hey, we should be doing this in a SCIF?
There was no classified material that was shared in that.
So then if there are no classified in material, share it with the committee. You can't have it both ways. These are important jobs. This is our national security.
U.S. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe taking questions today from Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm